Bandwidth for this podcast is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This week on the show, Jon Stewart is the new Walter Cronkite. News goes even more hyperlocal, and your Twitter strategy can't be a strategy. All this on This Week in Media, episode 144. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back with another edition of This Week in Media, and I am back. I am your host, hostess, whatever you want to call me, Hostron, Daisy Whitney. I was off for a couple weeks. I took a little bit of vacation, and the wonderful, fabulous Tim Street filled in for me, and I'm told did an excellent job. So thank you very much, Tim. Tim has a week off. I'll have him back on again next week. But I always appreciate his contributions, especially filling in for me, because my regular co-host... mentor, I guess that's a good name for you, Alex, was also a little bit busy. Alex, as many of you know, probably from the other shows, his wife had a baby. So congratulations for the Twim listeners who are learning for the first time. You have a little girl now.
Thank you very much. Isabella Amon, and she is doing great.
Good, good. We're very happy. And she has an 18-month-old brother. Oops, I'm looking at the wrong camera. How is he doing having a baby sister?
You know, I was afraid. I was afraid that he was going to be upset about it. But we brought her home, and he came over, and he just gave her a little forehead hug. Like, he put his little forehead against her head. And I was like, just when that boy, you think he's as sweet as he can be, he just ups it a notch. So he's been actually great. He's a very sweet boy, and he just continued to be sweet about it. So he's been great.
Good, good. Well, we're very happy for you. We have two new guests, first-time guests, I think. We have Tom Zahler, who is in Los Angeles, Skyping in from Los Angeles. And Tom is a comic book author of the Love and Cape series, a cartoonist, and just attended Comic-Con, so we'll touch on that very briefly. So, Tom, it is good to have you join us, and he's a longtime listener, so thank you for being on the show, Tom.
I'm glad to be here.
And we will very soon get into all the news from Comic-Con. And then our other guest, also a first-time guest, but a longtime friend of mine and business colleague who I've worked with for many years, so it's a pleasure to have you on the show, is Raj Amin. Hello, Raj.
How are you all doing? It's great to see you.
Raj is in New York. He is the CEO of HealthyNation.com with an I. It's a new spelling of healthy. Might not know about it. We're officially petitioning Webster's to change the dictionary. But anyway, so it's a site that has... health and lifestyle type of videos, and Raj started that up. He's an entrepreneur, tech genius, business guy, and just kind of a good media observer, so I wanted to have him on the show. And for those of you who are watching live on This Week in Technology Network, we're This Week in Media. I'm glad to have all of our live viewers, and for those of you who will be listening later on in the week, welcome to you as well. You can always get in touch with me, daisywhitney@gmail.com, for story ideas, whatnot. So to get into things, let's talk a couple newsy things. Let's do Comic-Con first. Is that over yet? Is it still going on? Are we in the middle of it? It doesn't matter when this show comes out on iTunes later in the week. Anyway, Tom, tell us about it. What was the big news from Comic-Con, and what was it like being on the show floor? Give us a sense of what it was all about this year.
Well, the show floor is kind of a Bataan death march for cartoonists, because you sit at your table and it's like being on a first date for 4 days straight, where you tell people, hey, this is my book and this is why I'm here, and you get people in. The two big news things that I saw were they had the cast of Iron Man there talking about Iron Man 2, showed a bunch of footage, the first footage of Don Cheadle replacing Terrence Howard. And the other thing was the Twilight Girls. That was new addition to the convention. They lined up 2 days before the show actually started. They were camped out. It was like a little homeless camp of cute, perky teenage girls.
And so that's, of course, because at last year's Comic-Con, that's when, that was before the Twilight movie came out, and that's when Catherine Hardwicke was the director of the first movie, and Rob Pattinson, and Kristen Stewart, and other members of the cast did their panel. And that was kind of, I don't remember if the first trailer for Twilight was shown then, but that was really kind of when it started to become clear that the movie had the potential to be this really big pop culture phenomenon, much like the book has become and really has mushroomed in large part because of the movie and because of the popularity of that. So was there, do you know if there was, were there additional screenings of, I mean, I don't think there was a new moon trailer that came out at Comic-Con. Was
there was a new, there was a new trailer that came out, I think, in front of Harry Potter, and they showed it there. And that was one of the, that was one of the big events. I think their panel was on Thursday.
Okay. So what is it like as a cartoonist there? You say it's a little bit like first dating kind of for 4 days. How do you measure the impact of going to Comic-Con? I mean, you're kind of one guy in a booth, and obviously you're competing against all of these, you know, huge movie franchises and book franchises and all that. What kind of traction can you gain individually from being there? Is it a must attend for you?
It's a must attend. I feel like if I'm not there, people forget that I'm in the industry. It's the place to go. During the show, I can measure it based on how my sales are, how many sketches I'm doing, how many books I'm moving. I have to bring out a bunch of product to sell. I've got 11 issues out in a trade paperback. And then it's how many meetings and parties can I get to at night? I try to convince people that going to the bars and schmoozing is actually work. A lot of people don't believe me, but it really is. That's why I'm writing off my beer tab from the show. And then I come up to LA and see how much of that stuff pans out with other meetings with other comic book companies, other Hollywood companies, things like that.
Now, do you have a sense yet? Can you measure the impact of that yet? Do you know your sales from that time period, or is that something you'll have to track going forward?
I know my sales. I think they're a little down from last year. I haven't compared against last year. There's a thought that a lot of the comic book audience is kind of inured from some of the economy troubles because they're, you know, Comic-Con is the big event. This is what they save for. This is what they show up for. So they're prepared for it. It seemed like sales and traffic were down just a little bit. On the other hand, I've got more positive reviews on the book than I had ever heard. People in the industry are coming up and telling me how much they like it. And if I can get that kind of traction to the point that when I introduce myself at a bar and say, I do Love in Capes, and they've actually heard of it, then I know I'm making the impact I need to.
Yeah, that's when you've arrived, right? When people at a bar or a coffee shop have heard your book. Now, Alex.
Well, being on This Week in Media is when I arrived.
Of course. Yeah, this is the real arrival. Alex, what do you think at Comic-Con is becoming from your vantage point? To me, it just gets bigger and bigger and becomes kind of this must-attend event for the media business. I remember on last year's TWiM when Comic-Con was going on and we talked about it. It was kind of rising up out of this, you know, kind of comic book phenomenon to become just a much bigger place. And I just think of all of the emails that I received this year just from, you know, press people in the TV business and just other people wondering, well, are you going to be there? Why aren't you there? It doesn't make sense that you're not there. So has it grown bigger than itself? And is that good or bad?
I think that is a function of the fact that we're seeing so many films and so many successful films coming out from the comic book, you know, arena. So, you know, when we look at Iron Man or we look at, you know, many of the other films that are coming out, this is the time to launch. I mean, those are the true believers, so to speak. And so those are the ones you have to sell, at least to have your core audience, you know, the people who are going to be, you know, whatever the tipping point kind of thing. You want to make sure those people are behind it. If they're not, it can really affect the movie. And there's a lot of these movies have a lot of money behind them. And I think that as those movies have come out, I think that's part of what's really built Comic-Con up. And I know that, you know, there's lots of companies. Anyone in science fiction, I think, is really, I mean, this has become, I think, one of the big conferences. If you're dealing with, you know, science fiction in general, I think that Comic-Con has become kind of the place to express that. There's a couple other ones, but I mean, that one is the major one that has really kind of taken over in some respects when it comes to this. Because I know that, you know, it's not just the companies doing the typical comic book stuff. It's also Lucasfilm. It's, you know, companies like that as well.
Hey, Tom, final question for you on Comic-Con. Any interesting, unusual, under-the-radar screen leads that you want to share with our listeners of projects that you came across, whether a comic book or, you know, maybe slightly under-the-radar movie that you heard about or saw or that people were talking about? Just anything to kind of give us a little teaser tidbit of something we might not have heard about.
Man, I wish I could. I didn't hear anything movie-wise. As far as things coming out, there wasn't. You know, they debuted a lot of new TV shows there. They had Eastwick, the ABC series about the Witches of Eastwick.
Right.
There wasn't anything there that seemed to have that kind of traction.
Okay.
And yeah, there were a couple comic book announcements, and there's stuff that I heard that was really good, but I can't talk about it until something gets signed.
Oh no. Okay. Other interesting news that just came out today, which is Monday. July 27th, is Ben Silverman, who is the entertainment chief at NBC, is going to be stepping down in September. He's going to be joining Barry Diller's IAC, some kind of venture, branded content type of role. Raj, I want to throw this to you because of your background in the TV business. Now, just to kind of set this up, Ben Silverman has been the entertainment chief at NBC for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, he ran Revelé, which is best known as the production company behind The Biggest Loser and behind The Office. So, you know, so he's a big deal TV producer before then. When you look back at his tenure at NBC, what's your take? And is this a surprise that he's leaving, or is this just kind of the expected 2-year tenure for NBC Entertainment Chiefs?
Yeah, well, you know, I can't say that what the tenure might be expected from NBC folks, but you know, I can't say that, you know, we're seeing a lot of blurring lines between television producers and advertising producers, and it seems like the new venture that he's going after follows that trend. You know, we've seen advertisers get much more involved in television programming. You can see that especially when you look at The Biggest Loser, which is one of the shows that he backed. So I think what I would say is that it's a natural shift for a leading television producer like him to take a stab at creating branded content kinds of enterprises and get a larger share of advertising dollars. You know, it's really interesting when you look at the types of people that have existed at big ad shops like YNR and others, you know, where you've got these creative directors that are fantastic at coming up with great content, consumer engaging ideas. And, you know, I think we're starting to see it go both directions, from the agency side to television and television to the agency side.
So is this just so is this good or bad for TV consumers? Is this, or is it just kind of inevitable? I mean, are we going to see more shows that are chock full of product integration? And is that, you know, in some ways that can feel like, oh, that's, you know, that's sort of annoying and advertisers are controlling the shows. But I don't know, maybe on the other hand, it's sort of the reality and what's needed right now for the business to thrive, with ad skipping and obviously web viewing and all of that stuff.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think the trick is to make it, you know, if it feels that way, then you haven't done your job right. So I think at the end of the day, you know, you're it's about creating content experiences. And, you know, what we're starting to see is that distribution has such a bigger force in the creative process. So, you know, essentially what creative directors used to ask is, you know, what does this content look like? What is the right experience for the consumer? Now they also have to ask the question of, where will it live? And so, you know, I think as you see people moving from traditional television who have been exposed to new digital platforms, now going over to create more interesting, engaging experiences for advertisers, it follows that understanding of looking at distribution and creative under the same creative process.
Hey, what do you guys think about, there have been a lot of, I mean, this is not necessarily new right now today, but there have been a lot of announcements, news stories recently about, you know, advertisers really trying to step up and do these kind of, you know, viral ads online. I'm thinking about one that came out last week that was talked about in the New York Times with Fred Willard doing this, you know, infomercial spoof for FedEx.com, where he just comes out as this very cheesy, over the top, you know, happy infomercial guy running onto the stage. And, you know, they're talking about FedEx.com and, you know, yeah, his daughter's in the ad. And she even says, I love to track on websites. Can this website do tracking? I was watching it this morning and it's got about 70,000 views on YouTube, which I don't think is really that, I don't think that's a lot of views for probably what FedEx was hoping for. I guess I wonder, have we passed the time when those kind of advertiser-led initiatives, advertiser attempts to jump into the viral ad business are effective, or is it just are we in a lull? Alex, what do you think?
Well, I think number one is, I think that a lot of times we don't know when it's advertiser-driven on YouTube. So there's a lot of viral ads out there that advertisers pay for that, you know, are not, we don't do them, but I definitely know some production companies that actually are producing stuff for YouTube on a daily basis. And a lot of times, you know, it's a smaller budget. They're producing a couple of minutes, and they're only looking for 10, 20, maybe 30,000 downloads, you know, sometimes more. But and if it takes off, it's great. But and a lot of times it's a simple, you just see a little bit of the client's logo, or it frames a conversation the way they want to frame it. You know, so there's a lot going on. It may not be in big numbers, but there's a lot going on in that area.
And so for the advertisers where they're just looking for a couple thousand, not necessarily a couple thousand, but you know, maybe, you know, tens of thousands of views, are those smaller type of advertisers generally?
Not always, because oftentimes they're not paying that much for the individual piece. So they might be paying $10,000 or $15,000 for something to be produced that is shot with consumer cameras and made to look like a home video. And so they're, you know, the cost per viewer is not very high. And so even if it's only 80,000 people, you know, so and there's a chance that it'll go bigger, you know. And so a lot of times, you know, that's the kind of stuff that is still, you know, floating around there. So I don't think it's dead in any way. I do think that, you know, you do have to think about entertainment. You know, people need to be entertained to watch this stuff, you know, and I think that that's something that advertisers sometimes forget, is they don't own their time anymore, you know. And I think that, you know, and there's a lot of ads that I watch, you know, that I wait for.
Besides, you know, Apple, what are your favorite ads?
So I have to admit, I find the Progressive ads very funny. Have you seen the Progressive ads with the perky little girl that's in the...
With a really big name tag?
Yeah, with a big name. You know, she's in like the white space with the shelving.
I don't think... For the insurance company?
Yeah, that one. That one. I love these ads. I don't know why. I think the actress that is the insurance rep, it just nails that character so well. There's so many, and they have so many different ones, and they're not very expensive, but they're fun to watch. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's just me. I don't know if other people have other ones that they like to watch.
Well, it's Raj, Tom, ads that you like to watch, not your own ads though.
There's one for, I think it's Wheat Chex. It's got Eric Pierpont as the chairman of the company, saying how much he hates change and he doesn't want to do anything and doesn't want to make anything better. And that one just kills me every time I watch it. Then I think there's a long form video on their site as well, but the commercial itself is just great.
Okay, and Raj, commercials that you like watching or any that have stood out to you recently?
Yeah, I'm actually trying to find this YouTube video. That's the guy that does the ShamWow. He did the chopper, the yeah, kitchen chopper, and yeah, it is the funniest thing I've ever seen. He recuts the whole infomercial against music, and it's hilarious. You got to check it out.
Wait, who's the brand? I think Colleen's trying to call that up right now. Oh, you got it?
Yeah.
The slap
chopper. It's funny. It is so funny.
All right, so this is a real, this is not just a viral ad? That's a real ad?
No. So the story is, this DJ cut this ad, and he got so many views that now companies are calling him to do these videos for him. Yeah, it's amazing.
All right, I like that. Really cool stuff. These are all good examples. And hey, you know what? Here's another thing off the top of my head that, Alex, I want to get your quick take on this. I was at the Nappy LA TV Fest before I was on my vacation. And probably the one of the statements that got the most attention and the most news coverage was something made by a Bravo executive from the cable network. They're talking about the cost of making web series and mobile series. And she remarked that Bravo had paid a producer $2,500 to make a mobile series. I'm not certain on the number of episodes. I think it was around 10 episodes. Very short, you know, probably a minute a piece. And basically... Bravo got ripped apart in the press for fleecing producers, you know, saying that was a tiny amount of money. And I've been meaning to follow up with Bravo and ask, okay, well, what is that really a small amount of money? So I will do that. But since you're here and you know all about production and costs, because I started thinking, well, okay, let's suppose that was actually a one-day shoot. I mean, if you're doing a mobile series and each episode is 1 minute or 2 minutes, you could conceivably shoot that in one day, edit it the next day. But Alex, you're doing that day in and day out at $2,500, and I know I'm kind of asking you to speculate from a distance.
$2,500 for each episode, or $2,500 for all
total,
10 episodes?
Total.
That would be not probably something that we would take on. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. You know, that would be probably even. I mean, we're kind of known for doing, you know, less expensive work for the web, but that would be probably less than we would probably even jump on if it was offered to us. That's $250 each. If that's how many they were doing. And yes, you could do it in a day. The problem is that it's not just a day. It's a day. You know, to do eight of them in a day or 10 of them in a day, it is, you know, there's days of writing, there's days of prepping, there's days of getting all that stuff done. If you wanted to be more than us just playing, I mean, the only person I know that can do 10 in a day that off the cuff is like Justine Ezrick, you know?
Yes. So,
you know, she can, I mean, she comes into our office and she'll shoot three while she's shooting other episodes with us, you know, but I think that in general, I don't, you know, that there's a lot of prep there. The reality, though, is there was a time when I would have done that, you know, and you know, when I was getting started, when we were trying, if someone's trying to prove something, there's a lot of reasons to do stuff for less money. Yeah. And the producer always has a choice. No one's being fleeced. The producer has a choice to turn it down or not turn it down.
You know, that's the, yeah, exactly. And Colleen was just whispering to me. She goes, nobody forced him to take it. And I thought that was a good point that wasn't pointed out in any of the stories. Yeah, maybe it's a really low amount, but, you know, he wasn't coerced or forced to do it. A producer always has a choice and can say no.
Yeah, I mean, one point would be, you know, is that what they paid the producer or is that what they paid for the entire program?
Yeah, and I believe that was what...
$2,500 for a producer is not, you know, I mean, that's a good rate. It's a really good rate, depending on how many days they were working on it.
Well, now, Raj, what do you pay? I mean, because are you able to share it all or give ballparks in terms of what you pay for the episode, for the web series that you commissioned for Healthy Nation?
I mean, the Girl Talk series is a television quality series. So, I mean, that's a full crew. I mean, that's a 25-person crew. I mean, we're spending as much as a television crew would spend. You know, it's upwards of a couple hundred thousand dollars for, you know, 15 episodes or so. So, you know, that's a different level of production. But, you know, if you've got a light crew going out shooting day shoots with a high-def camera that's, you know, on their shoulder, I mean, you know, you can get that done for a couple grand. So, I mean, I think it's really about the range. You know, what are you trying to do? What kind of quality are you trying to achieve? Do you want to have three cameras on dollies moving around a set, or do you want to have a couple fixed cameras? I mean, these are all changes that producers make to create a certain look. And, you know, in consumers' eyes, they know that that look is a higher quality look when you're going for that. And you know what? The advertisers know that too. So I really think it depends a lot on how you plan to use the video, you know, to when you figure out how much you're going to spend on a project like that.
What's interesting is that at many of the conferences I've been to recently, everybody, whether it's executives or independent producers, executives at websites or networks, everyone goes back to the example of Fred. Fred on YouTube is now held up as kind of a standard. And it's not necessarily a standard in terms of quality of production or whatever, but a standard in terms of what a successful show can be. But it was really fascinating that you had all of these network executives saying, I mean, you had... Greg Goodfried, I believe, at Equal, saying that's, you know, that's kind of the standard that we look at for our shows in terms of, is this as interesting as the audience of Fred finds Fred? But you know, hey, you can't argue with the numbers. He does pretty well. I was actually, but you know, it's funny. Everyone always says, I can't stand watching Fred, though. I mean, people who are, you know, older and covering the business. And so I've watched a few episodes in the past, and I watched last week's when we were talking about trying out for a disco routine. I thought it was pretty funny.
Well, I think that one of the things we have to think about, though, oftentimes is golf. When we think about this, anybody can hit a hole. The first time I ever went golfing, I hit a hole in one with a putter. You know, because I was drinking while I was playing, and
that makes you better.
So I got a hole in one once.
Right.
You know, but you know, my handicap is like 35. You know, so the thing is that it's one thing to be able to get a hit, and Fred is one of those hits. There's lots of people that have been one of those hits, but the what you have to look at when you're starting to work as an advertiser or a marketing agent or you're moving your own product is being able to do it over and over and over again, and being able to do it across products, and being able to, you know, and know that when you put money into something that you're going to get something back. And that's the, you know, one-hit wonders oftentimes can send you, not one-hit wonders, but someone who hits it and hit the right, they were the right timing, the right groove, the right whatever. You know, it's very hard to build a business model around that.
Speaking of YouTube, the site is now likely monetizing at least 12% of all videos streamed in the United States. You know, that's sort of a huge jump over numbers that have previously been reported from YouTube. This is coming from a TechCrunch story. And basically what that translates into is that YouTube is selling ads against hundreds of millions of views each week. compared to, you know, sort of its line before, have been hundreds of millions of views each month. So obviously we're going up to hundreds of millions of views each week compared to a month. So significant increase. And let's see, TechCrunch also says hundreds of millions can generally be taken as 200 million views per week or 800 million per month. YouTube also said through Google in its recent earnings call that through pre-roll ads against short form and long form content expected to be profitable soon. And soon can be a vague number, but it's interesting that we're at least using the profitable adjective for the first time with Google and with YouTube. So, Raj, I'm going to throw this to you. I mean, how does this sound? What does this mean, you know, in general for the new media business and then just for other independent producers? Or is YouTube one that's going to do well if it does?
So monetizing is good. We like that.
Yep.
That's great. But what does it mean for them? Is it branded advertising? Are they talking about overlays? What's the CPM? I mean, as we talked about earlier, you know, I mean, you spend a lot of money on creating high quality content. If they're monetizing 200 million views at a $2 CPM, it's sort of a non-starter for a lot of video businesses. So I think, you know, what it really comes down to is what are the metrics they're using to monetize those videos, and what are advertisers looking for? Are they branded advertisers? You know, I'd need a lot more questions answered before I figured out if it was good for the video business or not.
And of course, if David Pogue were here on the show, he would remind us all not to use words like monetize, which I myself am guilty of. It really means making money. Remember when he came on, Alex, and you said price?
Bluffed.
You said price point. And
I said like, price point, and boy,
like whacked you.
But I got smacked. I still got a little bruise.
I think you do. How do you think, Alex? What do you think about YouTube's money making prospects?
I think it's great. I mean, I think it's great for us.
No, I think this is encouraging news.
Yeah, I mean, especially as you know, if you can become a partner with YouTube, and if you can actually become part of that revenue stream, and there are people that I know that have become part of that revenue stream, and I think they're making, some of them, if they're getting a lot of views, are actually making a reasonable amount of money doing it. And so we're still at the very beginning of that. But as we look at, and I think that as we see YouTube HD, as we see the average, you know, we were just talking this morning that DSL is the new dial-up. You know, someone was asking me, you know, how fast my MiFi was, this wireless Verizon thing that I have. And I said, well, it's about as fast as DSL, which is I can do basic internet with it, you know, because it does 150K a second or whatever. Because at my house and at the office, I have 10 megs or above. That's going to be normal very soon. I mean, we're looking at these companies, you know, we're looking at 4G being 60 megabits a second, possibly. We're looking at, you know, 100 megabits a second costing $100 a month or less. So as we start to see that, we're going to see a lot more video, and people are going to be able to watch much more high quality video, and that means that's good for us as producers. That's a really good thing, and I want to see YouTube make as much money as possible, you know, doing this stuff. And I think that they're on the right path.
My take is that it's primarily going to be pre-rolls that monetize. shame on me. That make it possible for YouTube to make money. I mean, I think I think in some ways it's becoming clear that except for things that are specifically branded entertainment developed or brand led, I think that it's largely going to be pre-rolls, which is not. They're not necessarily my favorite thing.
I've missed a couple of weeks. Did you talk about the MTV research?
I don't know. Tim did the last 2 weeks. I don't know if he talked about it. I'm going to be talking about it in a new media minute soon.
Yeah. So the idea that it was five seconds of pre-roll with a lower third reminder in the middle was the most effective that they had found. And that's something I think that totally works. You know, 15 seconds is a pain. Yeah. 10 seconds is borderline a pain. 5 seconds, I'm willing to give 5 seconds up and a little lower third in the middle. And that I think that could be a very effective model.
Yeah, Raj, what have you found?
I mean, from our perspective, same thing. I mean, you know, having video to add to the experience, but then having a combined reminder ad along with it is the most effective combination of ad assets from our opinion. You know, we've designed our own player environment, and you can see from it that there's always a 728x90 ad asset that stays persistent with the video, and we found that to be incredibly effective when combined with additional video from the advertiser. And you know, when you look at pre-rolls, I think, you know, that's a great tool for volume, but you know, a lot of what we're seeing also is integrating long format video into the overall experience. So, you know, give them 60 seconds, give them 90 seconds if the consumer wants that, but make it opt in. Don't make it required like we do with the pre-roll experience.
Are you still using Brightcove, Raj?
Yeah, we still use Brightcove as our platform, as our technology platform. And, you know, we found it to be real stable and has grown with us. So so we've stayed on that platform.
What would you – now, I get asked this question a lot from sort of, you know, folks that obviously don't have the budget for Brightcove. You know, they want to know, should they do Vimeo, YouTube, Blip, et cetera? I mean, it's sort of one of those age-old questions that, you know, we've addressed on Twim many times before. But, Raj, I'm curious, what advice would you give – you know, would you give somebody like me, if I was just starting with a new Media Minute today, and I'm not going to spend money on – you know, on a platform for the free services, what do you think is the best?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I haven't looked at them all, you know, in depth for free platforms. I mean, we really looked at very high-end platforms that could support ad-serving needs and all the things that we required. I mean, we've been running an online business for 3 years, and so we knew exactly what we needed. And so it's bigger companies like The Platform and Brightcove that we were evaluating. You know, for the, I think, you know, generally what it comes down to is who's going to help you in all the areas you want to be helped. If you need help in distribution and marketing, there are certain companies, certainly like Blip TV, that does a lot more promotion for you and aids with the distribution. So, you know, I think it's really just a matter of looking at, you know, what they're offering you as a producer of content and how much they can help you sell your ads and or sell your content and get it distributed.
Well, and I think isn't you know, Brightcove and LimeWire, or not LimeWire, LimeLight, you know, these are much more industrial solutions than what the average person is doing. So if you're getting started, you might be using something like Blip. And I mean, and some larger companies are using YouTube and Blip and other ones. But I think that when they really want to integrate it with a back end, with those types of things, I think they start looking at these. You know, Kite is another one that we're doing testing on right now. KYTE is another type of service in that area. Brightcove, you know, and so all of these, but they're not for the average person just getting started, in my opinion. The price point is a much different model.
I mean, I think some of them have even tried sort of the just being for average consumers doesn't really work for them. So, but no, I think it's always good to touch on because, like I said, it's one of those perennial questions, you know, one of those evergreen questions. I was just asked by somebody last week in an interview I did for a blog post I ran on PR Newswire, just, you know, how do you decide, how do you pick what service to use? And because I use Blip for my videos and, you know, my take was, I mean, I don't think any of them are perfect and I've definitely had some problems and challenges. But one of the things that I do like is despite, you know, the technical challenges every now and then, is there always responsive. And to me, that was one of the most important things. This isn't a commercial for Blip. I'm just kind of, you know, answering a question that I asked myself. But that I think can be very important. You know, if you want to make sure somebody's going to respond, if something doesn't load correctly or whatever, if I send an email to the CEO, do I get a response?
Yeah, but Daisy, everyone responds to you.
Okay. Well, I guess I'm not a good example. That's one of the nice things about being a reporter. Okay, so you shouldn't listen to my opinion on this at all. No, can I tell you guys? I don't know if I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. I don't think Alex was on this episode, but I was having. Did I say this about when I Twittered about the UCSF headache clinic? Okay. All right. So this is where I will abuse my power from time to time. So I've been trying to get an appointment at the UCSF headache clinic and, you know, just kind of getting the runaround. And I was so frustrated. And I'm usually pretty good. People who follow me on Twitter know I don't usually badmouth anybody or any companies. I mean, from time to time, I might say something about a movie like The Ugly Truth, which was the worst movie I've ever seen. But generally speaking, I, you know, try to keep it a little bit more upbeat. But I was so frustrated. So I just posted a negative Twitter about it and saying I'm having the worst experience with it. And then I heard back from the PR person immediately and they wanted to know what they could do to help. And, you know, I got an appointment 2 days later. So anyway, but you should make sure, people, that you're getting the right customer service for you. Anyway, all right, let's talk about something else. When I always like to, every Thursday when I do my Twim planning, is to put the requests out on Twitter and Facebook and across the web. I'm working on Twim. What do you guys want to hear about? And kind of the biggest topic that people universally wanted us to discuss was the world without Walter Cronkite. I know It's probably been about 10 days or a week now since his death was reported. But, you know, we're talking really about the end of an era here. So what I thought I would do, and I hope you guys don't mind, I'm very proud of my father, but he worked with Walter Cronkite. My dad is a professor at University of Texas, journalism professor and former CBS producer. So when I was looking for interesting stories for us to kind of use as a reference point for The World Without Cronkite, I figured I'd use my dad's quotes. And he said, for people of my generation, he was the guy who told us everything. That's where we learned 40 years ago that man landed on the moon. It's where we learned Kennedy had been killed. You can't imagine what that meant at that stage. He was such a huge influence in America because he was so trusted. And, you know, I think this is a topic we've been discussing a lot on TWIM, especially in the last 6 to 8 months, kind of how journalism is changing. And I guess, Alex, I mean, this, would you say this is the, I mean, this has got to be the end of an era, but what is journalism like without somebody like Cronkite? Or have we already just, you know, said, fine, we're cool with that?
Well, I don't think it happened overnight. I think that, you know, it was an when you had something on broadcast, you know, and a handful of people that we watched to get all of our news, he was part of that era. And then as we looked into the 80s and the 90s, we had cable take off, we had CNN, we had other groups that are starting, many more people telling us what the truth is or the way it is, you know, and so that's built up. And now, you know, I think we're going to continue to have some people who are still aggregating that information or for us, still finding that information. But I also think that that's all going to be augmented heavily by the by the average viewer who has, you know, cameras nearly as good as the cameras that the people are shooting with on the news, who is on the ground, oftentimes understands the subject matter better, and of course are not enough on their own. But when you look at the budgetary constraints that companies are getting into, broadcast companies are getting into, and the opportunity of having all these people shoot for you, I think that we're going to see much more of that, and I'm excited about it.
Hey, Tom, is John Stewart the 20 something generation's Walter Cronkite?
You know, I think he is. He's the person who, when he does an interview, he's always respectful of the person he's talking to, but then he manages to ask questions that nobody else seems to be able to get away with. You know, he'll just kind of go up and go, what were you thinking? Are you sure you wanted to, you know, that kind of question that a lot of other people feel trapped by the confines of the whole normal news network setup. And yet he's pretty good about not stepping over people. I find the people who fail the most on his show are the people who try to be funny when they're not normally funny. It's better if they just go on and say what they mean, say what they feel, and he will help you out with it. For the most part, he'll even let you talk. He won't talk over you. He won't shout you down. They'll actually have a discussion, and there aren't a lot of places where you see discussions these days.
Yeah, he did a great job with the Jim Cramer interview earlier this year. I think last year he did a terrific job when he had Bill O'Reilly on the show, and that was hilarious. That was just, if you guys didn't see his interview with Bill O'Reilly, I mean, they both, did you see that one, Colleen? It was so funny. I mean, they both were just, it was just, I mean, they couldn't be on farther ends of the political spectrum, but it was just a wonderful chemistry between the two of them. Another question that I wanted to ask you, Tom, if you had, I don't think you're old enough to have an 18-year-old child, but nor am I yet, thankfully. But if you,
especially not mature enough.
If you had a kid going off to college wanting to study journalism, would you advise your son or daughter to pursue journalism or to find another career?
Well, I had some heated discussions with my mom about going into cartooning. And in fact, my grandmother was one who convinced her to finally let me give into it. That's why my publishing company is named after her and not my mother. So I wouldn't tell anyone not to go into anything. It seems like going into journalism to become a journalist isn't always the best way anymore. That it teaches you journalism as it was, and so many people who are getting into it, you know, like John Stewart, he didn't study journalism. You know, he found a way to make that work coming in from the outside, and there's a lot to be said for getting a fresh perspective. In comics, there are a lot of people who they learn to draw from reading comic books, and eventually their stuff looks like a copy of a copy of a copy. It's the people who bring something else in new from the outside, someone who started off as a graphic designer or, you know, studied figure drawing, you know, just anything that wasn't traditional comic stuff, that they bring something new that revitalizes the medium.
You know, it's interesting, the take that we have on Jon Stewart. I was having dinner with some girlfriends on Saturday night, and I think they're probably all Jon Stewart fans, but definitely do not categorize him as a journalist. And it's interesting. Raj, Alex, do you consider him a journalist now?
Absolutely. I mean, I would, in that, you know, he's digging into the issues from a consumer point of view, and you know, providing an intelligent opinion, you know, creating the forum for dialogue, which, you know, we get too little of today. So I do think that, you know, I'd see him as a journalist.
Alex, what's your take?
I think he brings us a lot of information in that respect. He is a journalist, but you know, I wouldn't consider him obviously as a traditional journalist, but I don't think that that's going to last longer. You know, I think we're looking at moving on, you know, to where we're getting our information from a lot of different, areas. I mean, I know that I probably, you know, that there's just a handful of people, but I find myself trusting Jon Stewart more than most of the other, most of the other news that I get, at least in the United States, you know, from United States stations, you know. And so and it's a lot more fun to watch too. It's a lot more palatable. There's a little molasses in that horse feed.
You know? I think that's a key point, you know, which is, you know, what is the role of information these days in terms of grabbing people's attention? The great thing that Jon Stewart does is, you know, he gets us to listen. And in such a fragmented media environment that we have today, just getting someone to pay attention is such a big part of the equation in conveying the information. So, you know, I think he does that very well.
I don't think it always has to be funny. I mean, I think that, you know, it took me a long time to come around. I know I'm way behind, but to listening to This American Life, is the best produced audio production in existence. I mean, no close second. I mean, I find myself just riveted, you know, by this, by just what would normally I would think of is boring. And they tease this information out, and they put together such a great story. You know, it doesn't have to be funny, but it does have to be compelling. It can't be just the news anymore.
Okay, so another interesting journalism story that I wanted to touch on very briefly. This is from a listener of ours, Dave from Giant Noise, sent this along to me. The Texas Monthly editor, and that's from Texas Monthly Magazine, actually really well-regarded political, primarily, magazine. He is leaving. That is Evan Smith. And is teaming with an Austin venture capitalist to form a nonprofit news website devoted to covering government and politics in the Lone Star State in Texas. He says it's going to be a lot of deep dive policy stuff. Now, and he's got a staff about 8 journalists that he's bringing on. And I guess what's interesting is, you know, under his tenure, you know, Texas Monthly won 2 National Magazine Awards, was nominated more than a dozen times. I mean, sort of a big time guy. I believe that they've already raised more than $2.2 million, obviously a very significant amount of money coming into journalism. And I think that this is part of where it's going, is that we're seeing these individual-led initiatives and these, I don't know that I want to call this hyper-local yet, because obviously Texas is very large. So it's, you know, hyper-local to me is more like, okay, here's the Petaluma news report. But I think we're seeing increasing numbers of these very specific types of new organizations or websites or magazines or, you know, sort of multi-platform news ventures that are coming up really dedicated to a particular sliver, which I guess isn't that different from what you know, is happening in the entertainment business and what we talk about with podcasts and web shows and whatnot. But, you know, I think this is a sort of another interesting thing to see. And I wonder if there will be others like this to follow. Who wants to take this?
Well, I think that this is less than a hyper local. It's a hyper niche. You know, you really, and I think that this is the future of a lot of media. I think that we're going to be, you know, we're on a show right now is a niche. You know,
right.
And we're, you know, and so I think that I think we're going to a lot more of that going down the path.
Sorry, it seems to me like there's this whole river of information that's coming at you that you didn't have before, that, you know, when I'm watching TV and there's a news tease for the 11 o'clock news saying you'll never guess who happened to do this, I can go online and find it before they reveal it.
Right.
So it's really easy for me to find little bits of specific information, but for any sort of analysis or any sort of long form stuff like he's doing with politics, politics in Texas, that's something I can't get just by being able to get information. I need perspective on it.
Right, right. And that's why we're going to see folks that are either leaving traditional news organizations or whatever it is, trying to find their own niches, their own opportunities. And I said niche specifically for one of our listeners. I can't remember your name, but who told us to stop saying niche. So anyway, that was for you. Hey, a couple other things I want to make sure to touch on in this show that I think were interesting is I read about this service HubSpot, Raj, on our friend Kevin Nolte's blog. Now, Kevin Nolte is a YouTube star, a former... Merck. Yes, he was at Merck. He left recently to really do his own thing, to be an online video star, but also more specifically kind of a consultant for companies that are getting into branded entertainment. So his website, willvideoforfood.com, is actually turning out to be a really good resource. I turn to it a lot now in terms of, you know, new companies that are coming up or just thoughts on how to do social media, online marketing, or whatever it is. So I definitely recommend it. But one of the companies he mentioned is HubSpot. Raj, I don't entirely understand it. So I know you are better than me at figuring out video and technology. So I'm going to turn this over to you. I want to get kind of a quick explanation for our readers of what it is, because it sounds like it could be kind of our readers, our listeners, kind of a good thing for them to know about. And there were some tips for promoting video. So what exactly is HubSpot and why should anybody care? Or maybe not at all.
Well, I checked it out and, you know, what I can tell is so the whole kind of video that they talk through is a real question actually that Nolte posted up, which was kind of an overview of what AMVideo is all about and how do you kind of manage SEO and how do you distribute it. I think it's really helpful for people that are getting into the space. Corporate video was one area where they talked about production tips and things like that. But for professional video, I would say it's not going to be incredibly helpful for the production side of it. But what it would be, this service HubSpot is great for analytics, and I think that's sort of the real value when you start looking at, I've produced this video, I've gotten it out there, how is it doing? That's something we spend a ton of resource on here at Healthy Nation, which is analyzing how our videos do once we put it out there in the world. And I think, there's a lot of companies out there. Visible Measures is another one that does a lot of analytics in this space. So it seemed like HubSpot was more in that world, which is, marketing analytics around video in the distribution world.
What do you use for your videos, Raj? How do you measure them? What sort of analytics?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of integration with Omniture, actually, mm-hmm. which is a traditional web analytics firm. But, we do a lot of our own programming around the video so we know what events we care about. So, a lot of what you're looking for is how engaged is the audience with specific videos, and then, what do you do with that engagement? Can you drive them in different places, like, connecting with advertiser sites, watching other related videos? Do they share it with friends? All these things are events that, you need to look at. And I think, there's more and more advancements happening in the world of video analytics now that are helping marketers decide what people want to do after watching one of these videos. So, I think it's a big field and there's still a lot to be done there.
Okay, so good company. We'll keep an eye on that, see what's happening with HubSpot. Alex, Adobe's new Flash platform, open source initiative. What do our listeners need to know? Our viewers? Nothing? Everything? Good, bad, ugly?
This is going to be pretty exciting. I mean, I think that Adobe is making it easier for people. Adobe has to. They're making it easier for people to use Flash, easier to develop towards it. They're opening up as much as they can. I think that's one of the big complaints that, for instance, companies like Apple has been kind of stonewalling the Flash on the iPhone. And it's not just the fact that Apple has, competing technology, QuickTime. It is that Apple's very concerned, for instance, about having a proprietary format that they are then beholden to. And it's something that you kind of have to read between the lines when you look at that. And I think that Adobe is addressing some of that when you look at that and really going after making sure that Flash continues to become ubiquitous, continues to stay ubiquitous, continues to be something that everybody's using. And I think by adding these tools, it provides that opportunity. I mean, I haven't dug into them any deeper than that right now, but I know that from discussions with them in the past, that's kind of the, making this much easier for everyone to develop towards is going to make a big difference. And there's a lot of things that Flash has to offer that no one else provides. I think that the, when you look at what they're doing with metadata, when you're looking at what they're doing with, those types of things, I think that those are real No one else is providing that stuff. And I think that unless someone else comes up, they're in the lead, but they can't rest on those laurels.
Well, I'm not going to pretend I have an opinion on it, which is why I have experts on this show. Raj, agree or disagree?
I agree. I think that's as far as I'm going to go. I mean, Flash has become the standard across online video for most parties. I mean, one of the biggest drawbacks that we've seen in the past is security and just understanding how can Flash be delivered securely so that you can't download it into other environments, because that becomes a big cleanup issue. Yeah. All right. So security is the only thing. I don't know anything about the new platform relative to security, if that's going to help any of the issues. I mean, one thing that I saw that just blew my mind was that when you loaded Real Player, and this happened maybe 6 months ago, there's an automatic download feature for any Flash video, and it worked on Hulu or any other major website, which was Flash-based, where you could automatically download a 30-minute show onto your laptop and store it, and that was a feature supported by the Real Player platform. So, you know, that I just, you know, having no security on a 30-minute show or 22-minute show, as it were, from a major TV network, just I found to be incredibly difficult to sort of understand how that could be out there in this kind of volume. So hopefully the Adobe folks have fixed some of those security issues, and those will be in the new version.
Okay, fair enough. So there we go. A couple final topics. There's some interesting Twitter initiatives, and I know sometimes we wish we didn't have to talk about Twitter here, but it's becoming bigger and bigger. Now, David Pogue wrote his book, The World According to Twitter. I don't think it's out yet, but he was basically soliciting input for it across Twitter, and now the musician Noosh Skaugen, gosh, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I practiced it a couple times. She's writing a Twitter song, the song of 1,000 tweets, so that will be based on Twitter messages. That's kind of interesting. Another interesting Twitter initiative is Twitter customer service. TechCrunch is talking about this Best Buy Twitter 12th force for online customer service. There are 3,000 followers. You can at reply a question, and Best Buy will answer it. It's in testing now with 700 Best Buy employees. If you want to know how something works, if they sell something, I got this. This doesn't work. How do I use it? It seems like they're responding pretty quickly. I'm lumping these two together. One is obviously kind of a B2B play. One is about, having kind of a community generated song, much like the sort of community generated book that David Pogue did. But I guess these are just, the latest examples of how Twitter is infiltrating, not just pop culture, but customer service and businesses. And everyone is kind of trying to figure out what exactly is the right Twitter strategy to have. On the one hand, are these just gimmicks, or will they have some sort of lasting staying power? I.e., does everybody need to have a Twitter strategy? Alex, I know you have an opinion on this.
Here's the thing: is you have to have a Twitter strategy, but you can't make it a Twitter strategy. I mean, that's the issue. Is that it's a much more, I mean, I find my experience with Twitter is that it's a much more, authentic relationship. You know, it has to be. If it's just a marketing output and you're just putting out what you're doing to, what the company is doing today, or little marketing things, it's not going to be very effective. That's the, when it's just an output for that stuff, when it is something that is about the culture of the company or the person, I put out everything from, by the way, we just released something. But, but I keep that to a minimum. I don't think about it exactly. I don't have the math of what it is, but it's probably one out of every 10 Twitters. I mean, most of the time I'm answering questions that people have sent me, about media or about all kinds of other things. And a lot of times it's kind of just offhand comments that sometimes are funny and sometimes aren't. And so I think that I really feel like I value this community that I have, that I work with on Twitter. But I think that's kind of how you have to approach it. I think that I've seen a lot of companies and a lot of people marketing themselves that only look at it as another outlet for their PR. And right. Even if you have a lot of followers for whatever reason, I don't think that's getting you very far. I don't think that's getting you very much reaction when you use it that way.
The whole point is sort of basic interaction. Raj, does a company need a Twitter strategy? I mean, on one hand, are a media expert. On the other hand, you know, you obviously have a vested interest in your company succeeding. What is your when you Twitter as Healthy Nation, if it's you, or sort of what advice do you give your team in terms of what the appropriate strategy is, or do you feel like Alex does, don't have a strategy, that it should be more organic?
Well, I think, you know, what we did was we actually brought someone in who had some experience with it. So I think, you know, bringing in, we've got a new director of marketing that handles that strategy and has social media background. So I mean, one of the things I've certainly learned is don't try to be the expert in everything. You know, if you can bring in someone that has some experience with it and knows how to speak in that community, that's going to be a great step forward. So we do have a Twitter feed as Healthy Nation, and, you know, we're learning the best ways to use it. But certainly I'd see it as, you know, very high value listeners in our Twitter feed that are giving us back a lot of input as to around different events that we're having or videos that we're learning as we go, like everyone else is.
And of course, Tom and I met over Twitter. He, when I was first kind of promoting, if you will, my bookchick.com site, which is my site that's all about books. And you were one of my first friends on Twitter for the Book Chick, and you sent me your very lovely book. So thank you for that. So you never know what Twitter could lead to. I have one final thing that I wanted to make sure to touch on. I found this very entertaining. I'm not going to try to give the URL here because it's long. So if anybody wants to see this article, it's pretty funny. You really need to see the photo. So just at reply to me and I'll get it out to you later. But there's just this hilarious post on if the media world were Harry Potter characters. Oh, God, this killed me. It's so funny. If you're a Harry Potter fan, even if you're not, you got to see it. Okay, so I'm just going to give you some of them. They basically did 30 media folks and said that, you know, so Draco Malfoy would be Bill O'Reilly, which I thought was great. one of my favorites. Okay, so the Weasley twins would be Colbert and Jon Stewart. That Anderson Cooper, this is great. I mean, you got to see the pictures. The two of them next to each other would be Fleur Delacour. You know, they're both so pretty with their silvery hair. I loved it. It was hilarious. Dan Abrams would be Voldemort. Rachel Maddow would be Harry Potter. And my favorite part was that our very own Brian Stelter, who's with the New York Times and is usually on show about once a month, would be Neville Longbottom. So way to go, Brian. I'm so proud of you for making it onto If the Media World Were Harry Potter Characters list. So yeah, so anybody feel free to tweet me and I'll link that up to you. I really enjoyed that quite a bit. Let's wrap this up. Tom Zaylor, where do you want people to find you?
You can find me at loveandcapes.com and on Twitter I'm loveandcapes.
Easy enough. Raj, where would you like people to find you?
healthynation.com. We've got a Facebook fan page and you can find us on Twitter too.
And don't forget that it's healthy with an I. And well, Alex, right. Where can we find you?
I'm on the Twitters.
Alex Lindsay.
Alex Lindsay, that's it.
Very easy. You can find me at daisywhitney.com, New Media Minute runs there, on Beat TV, on Huffington Post, and of course you can find me here as well. We are over and out. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.